inspiring and equipping you to live the life you're destined to live. This is the Ascend Men podcast. This is the second and concluding episode of our Through the Lens season. If you've enjoyed exploring this creative topic, let me know. I have plenty of other ideas around art and music. Last week, I introduced you to Andrew Wilkinson and Jeremy Dawson, who talked about capturing great visual content. Today, I'm taking the conversation to the next stage in the process with offline editor Rob Davis, who worked for all the big names, including the BBC, ITV, Channel 4, 5, Animal Planet, Discovery, and National Geographic. And to give you a sense of scale, Rob edited episode 2 of Life on Our Planet by Netflix, ranked top 10 in 79 countries with over 115 million views. Now, I'm not sure we'll reach quite that far with this episode, but let's give it a go anyway. Welcome to the podcast, Rob.
Hey, Alan, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. And I'm just interested in hearing about Rob and about what Rob does. So before we get to that, we always have a few quickfire questions. So the first one, favourite takeaway?
It's got to be a Thai.
Ooh, expensive but tasty.
Yeah.
That combination of kind of Chinese and Indian.
My wife loves the Thai and I've got to keep her happy.
Great. You keep me happy too when you invite me around. So now the next question, where are the most exotic places you've worked in the world?
Cuba, a beach in Spain, a yacht in the Antarctic, and close to the Sahara.
Wow. You're going to tell me about one of those. Antarctic. Tell me a bit more about the Antarctic.
So, yeah, it must have been, in fact, it was 17 years ago. It was two weeks after I got married, in fact, after I came back from honeymoon. And we were, I said goodbye to my newly wedded wife. And we flew all the way to the Falklands. And it was a 5.5 day sail from the Falklands to South George Island. It's 800 nautical miles. So it's unusual for editors to go on a trip like that. But of course, Channel 5, National Geographic, wanted it for Christmas. And it was documenting the change in spring in the Antarctic. So it was following penguins and lots of characters. And spring was October to December. So, of course, we didn't have time to edit it when they got back.
Right.
So me and another editor went with them. And as we left the Falkland Islands, it was cormorant dolphins, you know, on the bow of the boat.
Beautiful.
Which was amazing. And then after about 2.5 hours, we didn't see each other for about 3 days. It was so awful. The South Atlantic Ocean was so terrible.
Seasickness.
Yeah, seasickness. Yeah, incredible.
All right. So final question in our group of three. So I edit this podcast, so I know how easy it is to keep tweaking things, but I realize that there's often a law of diminishing returns. So how do you know in your editing when to stop?
Oh, that is a really good question. And of course, you can't just keep going forever. You know, it's like I think with editing, you know, with a film or a painting, you know, you can keep going, can't you? You can keep making it better or trying to make it better. But I suppose the job would have certain parameters, you know, in terms of the edit schedule, the time frame. So that's, you've got to try and stick to that, even though they do overrun. But there does come a point where you do think that you're recutting for the sake of it. And perhaps it's not making it better, it's just making it different. I think it's knowing when that's happening, I think, and trying to hold your hands up and just say, look, this is the best I think the footage can represent, or this is the best story this material can offer.
So we've kind of jumped the gun a little bit because we've already started talking about editing, but we don't really know what you do yet. So let's go back and talk about a film editor or an offline film editor. So what does that involve, Rob?
Yeah, so a film editor, I mean, it's the best term to describe what I do. It's offline editing now. It's digital. I mean, this is a phrase that came out before the internet, of course. So an offline means, you know, you've got proxy media or media that's a lower resolution that you can manipulate, you can move about in a non-linear fashion on an editing software. So it gives you so much flexibility, but we're talking hours and hours of footage. It's not uncommon for one sequence, for particularly natural history, you know, to be, I don't know, 80 hours of material for a 6-7 minute piece. So when you're looking at a 1 hour film, there's a lot of media, a lot of rushes to go through, and the job of the offline is to make the story.
Yeah.
to work from scratch, from nothing on your timeline, and to make that story, and you pick out shots. People say to me, "Oh, how do you cut out all that material?" And actually, it's not about cutting out; it's about selecting the glimmers, the little moments, the beautiful shots, the behavior of the animals, or the, you know, the, everything's got to sort of work towards the story that you're trying to put together, you know. And you pull out all these shots, and it's like painting a picture, you know. You're doing broad strokes, and then you start working on the detail, the windows, or if you're painting a house, for instance, you know, you as the edit goes on, it gets more and more intricate, and adding music and sound effects and commentary and narration, so you're heavily involved in the actual story.
So we'll talk a bit more about the story, but just to kind of let you know, we're not going to record for 8 hours here just for 20 minutes of audio. Like, I have a bed to go to tonight. But yeah. The storytelling really interests me. Like, who decides on the story? Because you've got people capturing images out in the field. You've got a producer somewhere. You know, you've got people who've written effectively, the script of some kind. And you're trying to put all that together into something. Whilst telling a story. So it seems like lots of people are trying to tell a story. How do you come to an agreement?
Yeah, well, it's I think you, as an editor, you'd approach whatever's in front of you differently. So a DIY SOS, for instance, is a 5-week edit. It's very quick. There's a lot of material there, and it's thought of quite intensively, apart from things go wrong with the build and everything else. But with natural history, there's a shooting script, there's obviously behavior that happens certain times of year, so they'll go and try and get that behavior, and often the schedule will allow them to go 2 or 3 times, and I might have 3 or 4 years in the making, and then they can assess whether they get that behavior or not, and it's scripted, whether it's character driven or a seasonal thing or whatever it is, but then there's huge play in the edit, you know, with often the material that comes back, you see it differently to the director who's had a vision to start with, the camera people who think they've got the best shots, you know, the editor comes in with an open mind and will look at the rushes objectively, and we'll try and strive to make the best possible story from that set of rushes.
Yeah, you mentioned DIY SOS, and that triggered a thought in me around emotion. You know, I put together some beautiful video and some great music, and my emotions are all over the place. I have to confess that. But when you're in it, like all that time, tweaking things, adjusting things, does that anesthetize you to the story and the emotion of the story? And something like DIY SOS, which is for me is a complete tearjerker. Do you find yourself being separated from actually the emotion of the story?
I suppose there comes a point when you know, if you've seen something too many times, then perhaps you do. But with DIY SOS, you are always emotionally involved with it. It's an incredible format. It's an incredible program. I mean, all the volunteers that turn up, the BBC hardly put any money towards the actual build itself. I mean, it's like over 95%, I think, is funded by all these volunteers. So straight away you feel a responsibility in the edit because all these people have poured their hearts out, they've given their time and their money and donated all sorts. There's a guy who owns a bricklaying company that just every time there's a DIY SOS, he sends his bricklayers down, and they're incredible. But telling the story itself, I mean, yeah, it's in the edit. Basically, if you're not emotionally affected within the first 5 minutes, then I'm not doing my job. We're not making the best program. But yeah, you want obviously the viewer to be attached emotionally in order to watch the whole film. And of course, they are really heartbreaking stories, so they should be. And to do them justice, it's hard, and it does take time to get them right. But not as much. The edit is quite quick with those. But
I can see there's a real depth to Rob Davis. So tell me about your heart and your faith.
Tell me about my faith. Well, I grew up in a Christian family, and my mum and my dad both heavily involved in the church. Were both elders. My grandfather was a vicar, and my dad's an organist and a choir conductor. And when we got to about 16, possibly, I just stopped going. Mm-hmm. I remember before I went to university, my mum said, "Oh, do you want to go and, you know, get involved in the CU?" And I said, "Oh, maybe, but I didn't. And did my 3-year degree, and I worked for a student union for a year, and I worked in a pub for a year when I was trying to find work. So I used to do voluntary work experience and phone around the companies every month, you know, and I got lucky and started working this company. And they asked me what I wanted to do, and I said edit. And so, of course, you have to start running and at the bottom level. And then I used to work late and digitize for the editor. I used to ask him if I could, like, can I edit like 30 seconds for you in there at lunchtime? And he'd say yes. And I got on really well with him. And I turned it one day, and there was an edit suite there in the room, another one. And we were doing 110 minute programs for Channel 4 at the time, called Endangered Animals, I think it was. And it was, so it was a brilliant learning curve. And it was funny because I just thought, I spent all this time working out what I wanted to do. I was good at arts at school, so I ended up doing art A-levels and an art foundation course. And I stumbled across audiovisual stuff, which encompassed graphic design, illustration, fine art, my sort of strengths. And I thought, wow, this is a brilliant way of encompassing all my skills. And then, of course, got into camera work and editing in my degree. And I thought, oh, that's what I want to do. So I sort of figured all these things out. And they were all sort of blocks of time that led to somewhere, you know. But I suddenly thought, is this it? But now suddenly there's a blank canvas. It was like the whole of my future. And I was doing what I wanted to do. I was being trained in what I wanted to do. But I just felt lost. And it was quite an interesting time for me. Yeah, I remember phoning my mum up and saying, Mum, I said, I want to come home. And she said, oh, no, no. You know, she said to me, why don't you go to church? And I said, why would I want to do that? Anyway, I found myself at the bus stop watching people going to church in Clifton in Bristol. And I thought, I can't go in there. They're all like perfect people, all amazing people. And I'm not like that. And church, it was about 650 people on there on a Sunday evening. And I was wondering, why are they all going in there? But I remembered when I grew up that all my mum and dad's friends and people from church were all really, I don't know, kind and considerate. They were honest and, you know, loving. And I sort of was missing people on that. So funny enough, that night I didn't go in. And then the week after, I found myself at the bus stop again. And then the third week, I did venture in, and I sat at the back of church, and I was... The music drew me in. It was quite an incredible place. And then one thing led to another. And I ended up being brave enough to go on to something similar to an Alpha course. And and I remember phoning my mum up and saying, Mum, you won't believe this.
And she's going, yes, all of those years of praying for that boy has finally come good.
Absolutely. Yeah, the reason why I sort of wanted to say that as well is because it was the start of my faith and my journey, you know, and I'd had this upbringing, but a lot of this head knowledge had become, you know, moved to my heart and stuff. When I first got this first job, I was staff for like a couple of years. I was trained up, and then the editor left. There was all, it's a freelance world, so everyone's self-employed and they all moved on. But I was there for a year and a half, and then the work dried up. So I was in a home group for a church at that point. And the prayer became, you know, give Rob some work, give this company some work. And after like 6 months of praying this prayer, I was getting really fed up because I was actually going to work, getting paid, but not doing anything at the time because all the work had disappeared. And I drove around Bristol one night in my 600-pound Cavalier, and this prayer sort of turned into this sort of rant at God. It's like, come on then. My prayer changed, and it basically said, okay, whatever you want to do with me, that's fine. If I'm not going to edit anymore or you've got other plans for me, then fine. And I think that was a point of real change, because the following day I got a phone call from another company who'd offered me a week's work somewhere else, and then another phone call from somebody else offered me a week's work somewhere else. And was terrified of asking the boss, you know, being employed and not doing anything. But he said, no, go and do it. And I think because my prayer had changed, and it was, you know, give me this work at this company, it was now, okay, I'm going to do whatever you want me to do. It was like a stepping out of faith of trusting. And I think God was waiting for me to say that. And of course, 27 years later, a precarious life of being self-employed. It was a really poignant time for me to learn that, and it was more to do with trusting.
Yeah. Sometimes you've got to give up the dream to have it fulfilled, I guess. Yeah. And that's your experience, which is you got to the point where you were so desperate, you said, right, whatever it's going to be. And then God gave it back to you at that point and gave you the desires of your heart, which is great. Can you think of a time where your faith has really opened your eyes to creation? And you know, you do a lot of wildlife stuff, so that must kind of connect together quite strongly in terms of creation and this amazing world that God's created and the stories that are written here.
It's well, I suppose some of the trips, I mean, the South George Island trip was amazing. You know, we were sailing past icebergs. I mean, like there were skyscrapers just passing us by. And I know Bear Grylls, whenever he talks about his Everest challenge, he sort of talks about Psalm 121. I lift my eyes towards the Lord, where does my help come from? And I think when you're in a place like that, you realize how small you are and how amazing this world is. We went to Bird Island, and which is at the time more people set foot on Everest than Bird Island, which was quite a fact then. But of course now there's lots of people have climbed Everest, but it's still the case that the Bird Island is not many people. And when we got to stand behind a wandering albatross, you know, and extraordinary huge birds.
Fantastic. And would you say there's ever been a time when your faith has constrained what you can do? Have you ever turned work away because of your beliefs?
No, there's definitely some programs that that I wouldn't touch, but I've never been offered them, so that's probably a good thing. and I stumbled into naturistry, so I'm very grateful for that.
So you've achieved so much. I mean, I look at your CV and your resume and things, and you've got all the big names on there. You seem to have been involved in so many different things and continue to be in demand for doing that. Do you ever find yourself reminiscing about a previous commission or something that you've worked on that you'd love to go back and do again?
I mean, I'm very fortunate to have, you know, a lot of highlights in my career when I look back at various projects. You know, there's definitely been quite a few that I've been pleased to be involved in for various reasons, really. And of course, Life on Our Planet was one. And I mean, it was just a brilliant, it's a really difficult story to tell. And when, you know, Amblin Entertainment involved Steven Spielberg's company and Morgan Freeman, even George Lucas's ILM were involved because they made all the VFX for it. Then extraordinary just to think that your name's on the same credits as those guys. You know, you just think, oh, I can retire now.
Yeah.
But actually I can't. I've got a big mortgage to pay. But,
other than that, you could retire.
Other than that, I could retire. But no, I mean, this has been great moments. There was Life of the Extreme as well, which was the one with Davina McCall. And I did the first episode of 6 1-hours. And that was quite interesting because it was the first one and she was contracted to film all of them. She had a bit of a wobble actually after filming the first one. It was partly being away from her kids, but also she thought, she didn't want to be seen as trying to be like Attenborough, which of course she wasn't because it was a completely different genre. And and when I got into the edit on the first day, the producers said to me, "Oh, actually, you know, we're not going to start editing the film. We're gonna do a promo." And I said, "Why? You know, you don't want to lose time and get on with what you're meant to be doing." And he said, "Oh, well, Davina's not sure about doing the next one or doing the series." And we sort of made this promo and then sent it off to her. And while I was in the edit, she phoned up and we put her on loudspeaker and I said, "Davina, this is brilliant. It's so good. You know, it's like being with your mate," because the premise was about being to these different places around the world and experiencing stuff, you know, and people and animal life and all the rest of it. And the viewer was following her and she was so funny and just brilliant. And we wanted her to do the rest of it, of course. And I just said, "Come on, it's not an Attenborough thing. This is just fun. It's ITV and it's great fun and you're brilliant at it." And she was like, "Oh, thank you, Rob." And I just thought, that's just incredible, isn't it? To think that.
And you had that influence. I think it shows the power and the influence that you have over people, you know, stars in some respects who kind of, I think you would almost been a shadow of, but actually there you are changing the way they think about what they're producing, which is great.
It was just a little moment, I suppose. Yeah. And you're talking to somebody that you think has lots of confidence,
yeah,
potentially, but they're just, you know, the people in a certain situation at the time. And and I think it's what's really lovely about doing my job, I think, is the fact that you've got something tangible, something that you've created, something that you can show that people can watch, you know, when you get 5-6 million people watching it on a Saturday night or a Friday night, whenever it is, it's lovely.
So you talked about retiring and not retiring because of your mortgage, and you've just talked about creating something that millions of people might watch. So do you still have a dream? Is there somebody you would love to represent, or something you'd like to show through your art?
That's a really good question, and I feel really bad that I haven't got something that comes to mind instantly. But it's funny because I just enjoy it, and I'm first and foremost so grateful to be still doing it, you know. And I was talking about it to a friend the other day, and when you get offered a job, it's great, and that's the first thing really, to keep being employed. And when something comes along that you feel really passionate about, then that's even better. That's a boosty bonus. But all the natural history stuff is just wonderful to be a part of.
So wind the clock forwards. When you've had that big commission, you've done the dream, you've made enough to pay off the mortgage and order your next Thai takeaway. What's the thing when you shut down Avid for the final time? What's the thing you're going to miss about your job?
The challenge, I suppose. It sort of encompasses all sorts of things. You know, it's partly problem solving. It's using your creative skills. It's able to work together as a team.
Yeah.
Produce something that lots of people can watch and that you're really proud of, I think. I'm not quite sure what I'd do if I wasn't doing it. I think I'll have to take up another hobby. Well, big hobby, I think.
But if you want to do any editing for podcasts, I know somebody who would really appreciate a bit of help. we often like to give our guys a bit of an action or a challenge or something to think about at the end of the podcast. Is there anything you'd want to leave with our listeners?
I suppose because I'm freelance and you know, work is precarious. It's always you know, I've gone through times where I haven't got any work, and I've gone through times where I've got lots of work and various situations, and it's always kept me prayerful, I suppose. And I think the biggest thing is whatever you do in life, you know, think about like Proverbs 3, you know, verse 5, it says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and then not unto your own understanding, but in all ways acknowledge him and he shall direct your paths. And I think, you know, ever since that time where I changed my prayer in that car, and it was good that it happened then, because I can look back and I've gone to that verse and I've made sure. So now I'd encourage everyone to do that, I suppose.
Rob, thank you for joining us on the podcast today. You've worked for many big names out there, but hearing your story, we can all see that you're working for the biggest name in history. With your skillful storytelling, you've impacted millions and millions of people, whether that's about penguins in Antarctica or laying bricks on DIY SOS. Thanks for educating and inspiring us today, and for giving us the backstory of Rob Davis.
No, thanks, Alan. It's been great to chat. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's brilliant.
God bless you, mate. Cheers.
And you. Take care.
That's it for this Ascend Men podcast. If you've enjoyed this content, please share it with a mate. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. Together, we are stronger.